So the first thing that I want to do is to take that small two-page handout, and first of all, just to review the principal points from section 3 of chapter 2. Then I will move not to this graph, which of the heuristic structures, that's for your use on your own private. I just lined them up, classical and statistical, but you can leave that. But I will move to the additional quotations that are basically taken from section 4. So first of all, then, the review of the principal points from section 3 of chapter 2. He's mainly talking here, and I think it's something that maybe I did not emphasize sufficiently but in the last class, about mental constructions that we can construct. First of all, ideal or typical processes according to classical laws. And then we will find that some of those that we construct can be, in fact, verified. In those cases, some insight or some set of unified insights will grasp the whole process and every event in it. The single insight or set can be expressed in a corresponding combination of selected classical laws, and any situation can be deduced from any other without considering intervening situations. So we are able to construct those, and we are able to verify them. There's no question that they can be verified. Secondly, a quite different type of process not only can be mentally constructed, but also probably can be verified. And he does not go further, although he's going to work on that assumption as the book goes on. But this is the expression that he uses. It can be not only mentally constructed, but also probably can be verified. That's his term, probably. The construction rests on the same knowledge, and this I maybe was not clear enough last week in my presentation, the same knowledge of classical laws. But the understanding is multiple. Different parts will be understood differently, and no single combination of laws will hold for the whole process. Process may still be deducible in all its events, but step by step. So the two different types of processes, one of which we can verify, there's no question about it. And again, it's a simple example that the astronomical movement of our planets in this planetary system is an example that I think all of us can identify with as a systematic process that can be verified. Quite different type of process that can be constructed and can probably be verified is the non-systematic, number two. Number three there, such a process, the non-systematic, as a whole, possesses a spatio-temporal unity, but no corresponding unity on the level, it should be on the level of insight or intelligible relation. Thus, it is a coincidental aggregate. If there is a non-systematic process, its basic situation, original situation, must be a coincidental manifold, a merely spatial unification of different intelligibilities that can be grasped only by a set of different and unrelated insights. So that this is the key, I think, right in here, is that the classical laws still obtain in a non-systematic process, but they don't obtain as a systematic unity. That's the point. Maybe I did not emphasize sufficiently last week. In other words, the intelligibility is there. It's not the random situation, if you want, does not mean unintelligible. Anyway, that's number five. So let me take number four first. Neither the process nor the basic situation is unintelligible from the standpoint of classical laws. They just do not possess a single intelligibility or a unified set of interrelated classical intelligibilities. Only because the basic situation is intelligible from the standpoint of classical laws is it possible that a non-systematic process can give rise to a systematic process, as in recent theories on the origin of planetary systems. So according to this worldview, the universe itself is becoming systematic in different parts and in different aspects. Laws are unfolding. And the unification. codification of the laws is unfolding as the universe emerges. We're talking about an emergent universe. And in that emergent universe, there is the emergence of systematic from non-systematic process. Classical laws obtaining even in the non-systematic process, but not for the whole interrelation. Random, thus, does not mean unintelligible, but rather it means lacking specified conditions of intelligibility. So from the standpoint of systematic process, non-systematic process is random. But that does not mean that it is unintelligible. In fact, as it says, it's possible to deduce every situation from the previous situations, but you have to do it step by step because there are factors that come in that cannot be accounted for in a systematic fashion. And sixthly, whether world process is systematic or non-systematic is a question to be settled by empirical method. So there's no a priori here. State both of the hypotheses, work out fully as you can the totality of their implications, and confront the implications with the observable facts. It cannot be true a priori that world process is either systematic or non-systematic. But to say that it is systematic, if in fact that's what one arrives at, if that's one's conclusion, is not to say that it is unintelligible even from a classical scientific point of view. Simply to say that no single set of unified insights of the classical type will be able to account for the process in its entirety, that there will be different sets or different aspects, okay? That the insights that will account for it will themselves be a coincidental aggregate. Okay? Be clear, and the main thing I want to get is what is he saying? Okay, Chris?
Just a question for clarification. Point number five?
Yes.
If random means specified conditions, lacking specified conditions for intelligibility, can we say then that random corresponds, or as non-systematic process corresponds to the empirical residue, in the sense that the empirical residue then will provide the conditions for systematic process?
Yeah, the coincidental aggregate that does pertain to the empirical residue. From the standpoint of the classical anticipations, this is left over. Coincidental aggregate is left over. So from that standpoint, this is empirical residue.
Okay.
If you've read this carefully, you'll notice. Now he doesn't state it, but in that chapter, he's using the word random for two different situations. Okay. Random, first of all, applies to non-systematic process. From the standpoint of systematic anticipation. Non-systematic process is random from the standpoint of systematic anticipations. But also, and what we'll see in a moment, random can also be used to refer to non-systematic departures from probability within the non-systematic process. So within this process, within the non-systematic process, there is an intelligibility called probability, and there will be departures from that that will be random, that will not be systematic departures from that probability, and that is a second sense of the term random. From the standpoint of probability, non-systematic departures are random. From the standpoint of probability, if I cast a coin 10 times and I get 6 heads instead of 5, that's a random departure from the probability within that process, within the process. That's a random departure. It's not considered significant. Now, if I cast a coin 200 times and I got 198 heads, The suspicion might be that there's some other factor that influences that. And in that case, then, the suspicion is that's not random. That's not a random departure. And so further investigation of what's involved, like maybe the coin is loaded or something like that. So, because it would seem that that's a rather extraordinary run. But 6 out of 10 instead of 5 out of 10, that's a random departure from the probability, which is the intelligibility that enables you to reach some general knowledge of non-systematic process. So there are those two meanings. Random is a relative term. Something is relative from some, is random from some standpoint. So from the standpoint of systematic anticipations, non-systematic process is random. But from the standpoint of probability expectations, any coincidental departures are random and empirical residue from that, coincidental departures from that intelligibility. So these are relative terms depending on what it is that you're anticipating. Does that help? Is it clear? The main thing is what's he saying?
So would you say random is not unintelligible in both of those senses?
Yes, I would say in both cases, because here it still is the case that the, for instance, let's just use tossing the coin to give it a simple example. The laws of mechanics still apply to every toss of a coin, and that's intelligible. So he is not claiming unintelligibility. Random does not mean unintelligible. And later on in the book, in chapter, what Orthodox Catholic thinker would be claiming an absurd or unintelligible universe? But he will later say that being is completely intelligible. It's just that it has different kinds of intelligibility. Not claiming unintelligibility when he's claiming randomness. And in fact, this helps it would help his own church, particularly at the time that he was writing this, when science was still under a great deal more suspicion from classicist mentalities in the church than it is today, to move beyond their suspicion of science, because one of the possible suspicions of science would have been that randomness means unintelligibility. Well, he's saying, no, it doesn't mean that at all. It's just random is a relative term. That from certain anticipations, there are departures, and they're random. But then there's no lack of intelligibility even in those. Is that Robbie? Yes.
What's the relationship of the empirical residue?
Each of these, it would be an empirical residue from the standpoint that you start out with. Okay? The empirical residue is what you abstract from. So when you're interested in systematic process, you're abstracting from anything that coincidentally departs from that. And you just leave it behind. Right? Or if you're anticipating probability, then you will abstract from any random departures from that. You'll say that from the standpoint of what I'm anticipating, they don't make any difference. So 6 heads out of 10 does not make any difference to the probability. The probability is still 5 out of 10. If the coin is equal and so on, it's completely balanced, the probability is still 5. 6, you don't worry about that. If that's your head, if you're worried about statistical intelligibility, you don't worry about a random departure. So that's an empirical residue. It's part of the empirical residue. What you abstract from to reach whatever intelligibility it is that you're after. Now, these coincidental departures have a tremendous significance for emergent probability. And this will come up more clearly in chapter 4, which is our reading for next week. Emergent probability is Lonergan's theory of universal evolution. And it's the coincidental departures from previous schemes that enable the emergence of new schemes. That those coincidental departures eventually become systematized. And then when that happens, you have, for instance, the emergence of chemical compounds from pre-chemical, I'm reaching for the term here. You have the emergence of life from non-life. At first, the emergence of life was coincidental departure, okay? But then it became systematized, and then you've got living systems, and then you've got the emergence of sensitivity, and then you've got the emergence of intelligence, and what's involved there is probably a lot more than simply the emergence from below. But you have this, what happens is that it starts with coincidental departures, and then those coincidental departures become no longer coincidental. And they become systematized, and then you've got living schemes of recurrence, and conscious schemes of recurrence, and animals emerging, and so on. So this gets quite exciting after a while. It might be difficult to stick with it right now, but it's quite exciting because there's a whole theory of universal evolution that's being built in the process here. Yes.
Just a brief digression. Does Lonergan ever comment on Peirce had this notion of agapastic evolution, which sounds a Christian-inspired notion of something that sounds very similar to this.
Finality would be Lonergan's term for that. Finality as the indeterminately but upwardly directed dynamism of a portion of being for ever new forms and ever greater complexification. It's very similar to Teilhard. His vision is very similar to Teilhard, the universal evolution. But it's a particular use of the term finality. Doesn't mean final causes. It means an upwardly but indeterminately directed dynamism to ever richer manifestations of being. And it would probably be very similar to Peirce. But Lonergan is very similar to Peirce in a lot of ways. The terminologies are different. And I find Peirce's terminology even more complex than Lonergan's. But I think there are great many similarities between them.
So, by randomness, and in both of those instances, is he referring to like the discrepancy between theory and observation, theory and fact? Like, it seems in both cases, what we're saying is that we mentally will construct some model which does not completely describe the real world, and the fact that our model cannot entail what's completely in the real world, there's random things. That's where the randomness comes in.
Random, yeah, and it is random with respect to
a model of what I anticipate.
So it would be the difference between what's anticipated theoretically,
right.
And both
right.
of these are theoretical.
Right.
Well, statistical is theoretical as well. I mean, statistics is extremely,
right, exactly.
extremely
exactly.
difficult science. Very difficult science. It's hard. Some of the hardest. When I was a psych major to start out with, I had to take several statistics courses. They were some of the most difficult things I've ever done, partly because of a lack of background in mathematics. But anyway, it's very theoretical, statistical science. And so it's a difference between those theoretical anticipations and, in fact, that some concrete particularities that diverge in one form or another from those. But none of these are unintelligible. This comes under, for instance, the laws of mechanics, and that obtains. They obtain that. For every toss of the coin, it's completely subject to the laws of mechanics. And if you wanted to, you could figure it out.
So, but even evolutionarily, whatever, in terms of evolution, the only reason I might suspect that the Earth, that the world, could have evolved any differently than it did, is because I'm applying some theory to it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I mean, what happened, and there's no...
Yeah, okay, there's a little bit more to it than that, in the sense that, as we'll see in Chapter 4, for some schemes to emerge, others have had to emerge first.
Right.
So, for instance, you couldn't have life without a certain complexification of chemical, of the underlying chemical manifold. You couldn't have consciousness without life. You couldn't have intelligence without sensitive. So there are things that are needed for, there are earlier schemes that are needed for the later schemes to emerge. But, so in that sense, but still that doesn't second change, or that doesn't change what you were saying radically. Okay, so then let's take the additional quotations that he addresses in section 4. And then I think we can move on into the next into the next chapter. And in chapter three, I'm not going to devote a lot of time to the canon of statistical residence, because I think I've said enough about it now that you can, that it's enough for us to move on. And it's a very complicated part of the chapter. I'm also going to skip a couple of other things, but I'll mention it when we come to it. But let's just take these just to make sure that we've got the chapter two, because I don't want to not say the things that I think are essential. It's the movement of dice, so we're taking that as an example. These are quotes now from the book. The movement of dice observed perfectly the laws of mechanics. But the laws of mechanics are not premises in the determination of the probability of casting a seven. Doctors commonly succeed in diagnosing the causes of death, but such causes are not studied in fixing death rates. It's rather the frequency. So that's what they're interested in the death rates. The statistical scientist, for instance, now, I mean, I can give you one from my own experience here, that the death rates in a particular community, the community of people affected by AIDS, in 1995 in the city of Toronto, were high. Much higher than they are today. And then there's this change. And that change was so drastic that it could not be considered to be simply a random departure from the rates that were set. And in fact, we know what the reason for the change is, because new medications were developed that enable people to live longer. So, but that would be an instance of there are certain death rates that are set that are on the basis of concrete empirical accounting. And then it's so many per population, and per this population, and per that population, and so on. And those were the rates. And then there's a change, but the change is obviously it's accounted for. But the death rates are different. But what the statistician is interested in is studying the rates, counting and figuring out per population what the death rates are going to be. The statistical scientist seems content to define events and areas, to count the instances of each defined class within the defined area, and to offer some general but rather vague view of things as a whole. Statistical science directs its attention to frequencies that are straightforward numerical answers to the straightforward question, how often? How often in a population of 1,000 are people going to die of X, Y, or Z? Such frequencies may be ideal or actual. The actual you know by counting. The ideal you know by anticipating a probability. Probability is an ideal frequency. Statistical inquirers make it their business to distinguish in their table of frequencies between significant and merely random differences. As long as differences in frequency oscillate about some average, they are esteemed of no account. Of no account from the standpoint of anticipating a probability. It doesn't mean they're unintelligible. They're of no account from that standpoint. Only when the average itself changes is intellectual curiosity aroused and further inquiry deemed relevant. Next. These are all from 77, I guess. It seems quite possible to acknowledge random differences in frequencies and at the same time to maintain that single events are determined, that they are not random, so that casting of the dice, for instance, is not in itself random. It's all under the laws of mechanics, even that they are deducible. If we are to discover a fully general account of the meaning of random differences, we must look not to single events, but to events as members of a group. So the question becomes, how can there be a defect in intelligibility in a group of events if each event singly is quite determinant, if none are random? Another instance of the spell checker not helping. And if one by one all may be deduced, okay? How can there be a defect in intelligibility? Well, it's a defect from a certain anticipation, okay? But it's not a defect in itself. There's still intelligibility that applies. And in response to that question, here's his answer. First, statistical inquiry is concerned with coincidental aggregates of events and not with systematic process or with events taken singly. The object of statistical inquiry is the coincidental aggregate of events, the aggregate that has some unity by spatial juxtaposition or by temporal succession or by both, but lacks unity on the level of insight and of intelligible relation. In other words, statistical inquiry is concerned with non-systematic process. Secondly, statistical inquiry investigates what classical, let me use this, what classical inquiry neglects. It investigates what is non-systematic. And you know, the classical inquiry doesn't investigate that. For even if one grants that classical inquiry leads to the laws that explain every event, it remains that classical science rarely bothers to explain the single events of non-systematic process, and still less does it offer any technique for the orderly study of groups of such events. Thirdly, statistical inquiry finds an intelligibility, probability, in what classical inquiry neglects. Fourthly, it is this further intelligibility, probability, that is denied when random differences are observed. That is to say, from this standpoint, these are random. Okay. What is that intelligibility? Its name is probability. In the insight that grasps probability, the inquirer abstracts from the randomness in frequencies to discover regularities that are expressed in constant proper fractions named probabilities. Probability gives some general knowledge of events in non-systematic processes. That general knowledge has to do with states, which are defined by the association of classes of events with corresponding probabilities. So if you look at that, this list here, this table, as classical anticipates the nature of, so statistical anticipates the state of whatever it is that you're studying. A probability, from page 83, a probability is a number that cannot be reached from the data of a problem without the intervention of an insight. And it's not reached just by counting, because you can count and you can say 6 out of 10, and then you count and say 3 out of 10, and so on. But there's something else, you've got to go beyond just counting. Probability lies concealed within the random oscillations of relative actual frequencies. Intelligence can reach probabilities by abstracting from the random oscillations of relative actual frequencies to discover a set of universally valid constants. 84. Intelligibility of the classical type is to be excluded not from single tosses, they all come under classical intelligibility, but from the sequence of tosses precisely as a sequence. It is not to be excluded from single tosses, for there is no reason to suppose that tossing a coin involves a suspension of the laws of mechanics or of any similar science. It is to be excluded from the sequence as a sequence, for we have every reason to assert that a sequence of tosses is not a systematic process. Hence, every sequence of actual combinations of determinants is a coincidental aggregate. 85. The relative actual frequencies of heads, number one, can and often do differ from 1/2, but two, only at random, unless you're using an American quarter, and three, in a manner that yields an oscillation about 1/2 as a center. Intelligence then can grasp a regularity in the frequencies by abstracting from their random features and by settling on the center about which they oscillate. That abstractive grasp of intelligibility is the insight that is expressed by saying that the probability of heads is 1/2. And 85, however, it's only in games of chance like that that you can discern ahead of time an antecedent symmetry in a set of possible combinations of determinants of events. In other instances, probabilities have to be reached a posteriori, and to reach them, a statistical realistic structure has to be developed. And then that's what this page is all about, but I don't think we need to go into any further detail on what he says about the statistical realistic structure. There was something that I just thought of. For one more moment, and then we can go on to chapter 3. Are we okay with this? Oh, I know what I was thinking of before. Later on, see, a lot of times there's the little riders that possibly, maybe he could have added just to make it clear that it's from the standpoint of those anticipations that you have one kind of randomness. From the standpoint of these, you've got randomness takes on a certain different meaning. Later on, he'll say that from the standpoint of God, if it's true that God knows everything about everything, he'll use the expression, the non-systematic vanishes. Now, what he means by that is not that there isn't non-systematic process, but it's not a problem. Okay, it's a problem for us because we could figure out everything, but it would take a long time to do it, and God doesn't have a problem. that's what it means by the non-systematic vanishes. It vanishes as a problem. It doesn't mean that from God's standpoint, the universe is all systematic. No, it just means that from God's standpoint, the universe is completely known. But that doesn't mean that it's not systematic. Okay? And I hope I'm not leaving you behind. I want to be sure. Are you okay? You got it? All right.
I just needed another name for God then, and I suppose we have it already. This is what we meant in the catechism years ago, that God is all-knowing.
Yeah.
But Monica's take on it, it's
unrestricted active understanding.
Well, that anyway, that's way definitely
yeah.
Second semester.
Yeah, no, but I was just taking a much simpler.
Okay, section, chapter 3 then, the canons of empirical method. And what I'm going to do here, I'm going to take the first 7, and maybe we can do that before the break. I'm going to skip numbers 8 to 14 because they just fill out the second canon, and I don't think they're all that important for the remainder of the book. And then I'm going to take 15 down to whatever, but the third, fourth, and fifth, and then I'm going to leave the canon of statistical remedies because I think they've said all that needs to be said about it. So number 1, there are rules or canons that de facto govern the fruitful unfolding of the heuristic structures of empirical science. This doesn't mean that every scientist says, well, I've got to follow these 6 canons and so on, but in fact, these are observed in successful scientists. And a study of insight helps to explain them. He specifies 6 of them. And his aim is not the history of the development of empirical method, nor descriptive accounts of what scientists do, nor an argument based on the authority of great names in science, nor a summary of directives, precepts, and recipes to guide in the practice of scientific investigation, but rather insight into insight. What is the intelligible unity that underlies and accounts for the diverse and apparently disconnected rules of empirical method? And that if discovered, and this is his language on page 94, will unify method and exhibit the fact and nature of insight. And I just have a comment here. Obviously, he wrote this before Gadamer's book, great book, Truth and Method, appeared. Thought it was a great book, and he draws on it in Method and Theology, as you would know if you read it. But note here the unification of method, to unify method, in the light of Gadamer's well-intentioned but perhaps overstated divorce between truth and understanding on the one hand and method on the other. For Gadamer, method is strictly scientific in the modern sense of the term. For Lonergan, there's a more basic meaning of the term method that is behind that. Generalized empirical method, transcendental method, those are the two terms that he uses for it. There's a set of procedures that are followed in all instances of human knowing. And that's what he's getting at when he uses the term method or basic method and so on. But I think this issue is a major one for the potential convergence of relatively contemporary philosophical concerns. Is there a procedure that cuts through and is found in all of the following mutatis mutandis, natural science, human science, interpretation, history, common sense, etc.? Lonergan would say yes. And I think he finds, as a matter of fact, evidence for that in Gadamer's own writing, although Gadamer uses the term method to refer only to natural science. That's the point that I'll make, just in case you have any interest in those contemporary philosophical issues, which I do, but he's extremely favorable to Gadamer, as you'll find out if you get a chance to talk to Fred Lawrence when he comes in a couple of weeks. He's done amazing work on Gadamer and Gadamer. Ends up really integrating them with one another, not making one exclude the other. Secondly, then, the first canon is the canon of selection. Page 93, it's the following. The empirical inquirer, so the physicist, the chemist, the biologist, the botanist, is confined to insights into the data of sensible experience. So they don't go beyond that. Again, if a correlation or hypothesis or probability expectation or theory or system pertains to empirical science, then, number 1, it involves sensible consequences, and 2, such consequences can be produced or at least observed. Inversely, empirical method prescinds from all questions and answers that do not involve distinctive sensible consequences. And it discards all that involve such consequences logically, yet fail to be confirmed by the results of observation or experiment. So there's some selection that is obviously needed, and this canon enables scientists to discard all correlations and theories that have been tried and found wanting in terms of sensible consequences, and to direct their attention to issues that one can settle by the decisive evidence of observation and experiment. Now, he'll say later, that doesn't mean that other questions don't have any significance. It's just that they're not questions that can be settled by the canons of empirical method in modern science. Next, nonetheless, the sensible consequences may be very slight and demanding elaborate apparatus to detect them. And grasping how a correlation or law involves or implies sensible consequences may suppose a profound mastery of the field. You might need elaborate machinery to discover the sensible consequences. It could be a little movement on a die, that's all. A capacity to follow recondite and intricate mathematical operations, and the audacity necessary to form new primitive concepts and to follow long chains of abstract reasoning. And this was the thing that I just said. Questions that do not satisfy the canon of selection may still be relevant elsewhere. For one thing, in addition to the data of sense, there are also the data of consciousness. And we appeal to in this book to set up a cognitional theory. In fact, that's what he's doing right now, is he's actually taking us through some of what we would consider to be data of consciousness. It says on page 96, if it is true that essentially the same method, experience, understanding, judgment, could be applied to the data of consciousness, then respect for ordinary usage would require that a method which only in its essentials is the same be named a generalized empirical method. So empirical method, sensible consequences. Generalized empirical method, data of sense and data of consciousness. Same steps, experiencing, understanding, judging, both. We'll come back to that in many different ways and in many different. So, number five, what are sensible data? Well, in general, the contents of acts of seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling. But all such contents emerge within a context determined by interests and preoccupations. He frequently gives the example of a bug. There's a bug on the table, and I see a bug. If an entomologist looks at it, he or she sees things I don't see. Sees them. Of the interests and preoccupations. They would have to point it out to me. Look at this. Oh yeah. But I see it. Scientific observation is not some mere passivity to sense impressions. It occurs within its own dynamic context, and that context is different from the orientation of concrete living. More precisely, what differentiates the perceptual flow in one person from that of another is found in the pattern of interests and objectives, desires and fears that emphasize elements and aspects of sensible presentations, enrich them with the individual's associations and memories, and project them into future courses of possible fruitful activity. He's introducing us subtly here to the extremely important notion of patterns of experience. This will come up in chapter 6 in a way that is very existential and dramatic and moving beyond the context of science, but this is one pattern of experience, this scientific pattern. To become a scientific observer is to bring the raw materials of one's sensations within a new context. The interests and hopes, desires and fears of ordinary living have to slip into a background. In their place, the detached and disinterested exigencies of acquiring intelligence have to enter and assume control. Memories will continue to enrich sensations, but they will be memories of scientific significance. Imagination will continue to prolong the present by anticipating the future. But anticipations with a practical moment, as in everyday living, will give way to anticipations that bear on a scientific issue. The guiding orientation of the scientist is the orientation of inquiring intelligence, the orientation that of its nature is a pure, detached, disinterested desire simply to know. For there is an intellectual desire, an eros of the mind. Without it, there would arise no question, no inquiry, no wonder. Without it, there would be no real meaning for such phrases as scientific disinterestedness, scientific detachment, scientific impartiality. And as much as this intellectual drive is dominant, and as much as the reinforcing or inhibiting tendencies of other drives are successfully excluded, in that measure, the scientific observer becomes an incarnation of inquiring intelligence. And his or her percepts move into coincidence with what are named the data of sense. So as I said, this statement serves also as a kind of introduction of the notion of patterns of experience that will become important later on. In chapter 6, we'll speak of the intellectual pattern of experience, which is what he's talking about right here, the aesthetic pattern of experience, the biological pattern of experience, the dramatic pattern of experience. And later on, he'll speak of the mystical. They're all different organizations of our experience, depending on our concerns, our interests, our needs, our desires, our wants, our fears. He's introducing us to this one, the intellectual, as it unfolds in science. But it's not the only, obviously not the only pattern. Nor is it the privileged pattern in a lot of ways. It's the dramatic pattern in which we live our lives. It's in the dramatic pattern that one makes a decision to devote oneself to the intellectual pattern. So it's the dramatic pattern that we are living in, our interrelations with one another, and so on. And that's the pattern that counts in terms of the integrity of the person, the dramatic pattern. But there's something from the intellectual pattern that is very important in the dramatic pattern. And that is that even if it's in terms of, for instance, human relations, that you need to figure something out, well, make sure that no other desires and fears are entering in there that would prejudice and bias your judgment. So that, and that's something that the intellectual pattern can embody and does embody when it's functioning authentically. That is also needed in everyday living so that we are not overcome by biases. Bias will be an interference in everyday living that enables us, that prevents us from authentic performance in that everyday living. And there's something about the expression he uses is detachment, which of course can mean, can have all kinds of connotations that are not really. He says in Understanding and Being, probably it's something that you've already listened to if you've listened to the MP3, I think, because it's very early on, it's in one of the discussions, that detachment is the most involved state, that you're really involved when you prescind from everything except what's really important to the issue that you're trying to deal with, whether that be in the intellectual pattern. His later term for all of that, rather than detachment or disinterestedness, will be self-transcendence, which is a term I think that we can relate to without the negative connotations that sometimes can attach to those other terms. The second canon is the canon of operations. The scientist aims at an accumulation of insights into the data of sensible experience, and the accumulation is reached not in the mathematical circuit, as we saw last week, through insights, formulations, and symbolic images, but in the fuller circuit that adds other operations, observations, experiments, practical applications. Or another way of putting the same canon, just as inquiry into the data of sense yields insights that are formulated in classical and statistical laws, so inversely, the laws provide premises and rules for the guidance of human activity upon sensible objects. It's something that's made a great deal of in a lot of contemporary philosophy of science, of how science changes the data. Well, it's through the operations that the data are changed. Such activity, in its turn, brings about sensible change to bring to light fresh data, raise new questions, stimulate further insights, and so generate the revision or confirmation of existing laws, and in due course, the discovery of new laws. And I'm just adding here, note a cautious statement the role of the scientific observer in modifying the observed data, a position very prominent in contemporary philosophy of science. we okay up to this point? Nadia.
I'm still wondering about the distinction between date of sense and date of consciousness.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
if all that we experience in terms of sensory experience has to be perceived, doesn't that become in some way a date of consciousness?
Well, that becomes a date of consciousness, but not every datum of consciousness is a datum of sense.
No.
So,
yeah,
okay.
I can
so
see
your
that.
Your sense, yeah, that your sense perceptions are data of consciousness. But beyond the sense perceptions, there are things like questions. Well, you don't see a question, but you experience a question.
But then, is there such a thing as a date of sense?
Sure. That's a datum of sense right there. It's also a datum of consciousness. Is there a datum of sense that is not a datum of consciousness?
Okay, that would be the question.
but consciousness is more than sense.
Yeah.
Consciousness is inquiry, insight, reflection, judgment, evaluation, deliberation, decision. And we experience those, but we experience those in the realm of interiority. And we don't see an insight. We talk about, we use sensitive metaphors talking about the light went on. That's a metaphor. We know it. The light went on in Helen Keller, but she didn't see it. That was the insight. And that's the end of consciousness. And there's again, if you saw the movie The Miracle Worker, I don't know whether you've seen it, it's an old movie, but it's her story. But the excitement, that when she recognized the fact that the signals meant something, she just ran around the room and touched everything. What's the signal for that? What's the name of this? What's this? What's this? Older world, but it's insight inside. I mean, in you talk about it however you want, but it's in his word for it is interior. All right, now I'm skipping 8 to 14 because it just goes further expansion on that I don't think is particularly important, and I want to get to the issue of data of consciousness comes up again in the chapter, and I want to get to that. So we're at 3 o'clock, let's take our break. Unless there are any other questions before you, but Chris?
I have one question. On page 2 of your notes, in the ... right before you get into the bold area?
Yes.
During that section there's just a transition that he makes on that page that I just would like some clarification on.
Page is 96, is it?
Page 97.
Okay.
It's the second paragraph where he says, still there are differences in such developments, and to this fact the scientist alludes. Scientific observation, the matter of seeing, just there's to be seen. So is he saying, is that like a charge against what he calls naive realism there?
Oh, I see. At the very beginning of the paragraph. Yeah, that's that.
But the real question that I have is, I took that to be a charge against naive realism. In other words, we can't say that scientific observation, equivocates that just seeing just what there is to be seen, hearing what there is to be heard. However, even though we can't take that literally, because the scientific observer is under the dominance of a guiding orientation.
Yes.
So the reason that we can't take naive realism, if that's what he's talking about there, literally, is because we're under the dominance of a guiding orientation. It's that dominance of the guiding orientation that allows us to know it all.
Right.
So there's kind of like, well, in other words, I'm fallible because of this dominance of guiding orientation?
No, what he's really getting at in the first part of that, and the reason that I skipped it, is the notion of objectivity, and which will come up in greater detail. And I'll skip it, but since you're asking about it, I'm not going to skip it. I'll address it right now. There is a notion of objectivity that is, well, it's a matter of taking a good look at what's there and seeing what's there and not seeing anything else, but seeing everything that's there. And that's what he's alluding to here. When people talk this way, they're presuming that notion of objectivity. And that, he says, is a problematic notion of objectivity. Objectivity is not a matter of seeing all that's there and nothing that isn't there. Yeah, that's just the beginning. That's what he calls experiential objectivity. That's being attentive. But there's much more to objectivity than just seeing all that's there and hearing everything that there is to be heard and so on. There's much more to objectivity than that exteriority. Objectivity is starts with that, and you must, of course, attend to the data. But objectivity is a matter of authenticity in moving towards judgment. And so the objective person is the authentically subjective person. Objectivity is the fruit of authentic subjectivity. And objectivity in its fullness is reached in true judgments and not in taking a good look. So that's what he's, where he says there's a problem with that expression. But he doesn't mean that you don't, I mean, obviously, if you miss any of the data, and especially in science, then you got to start all over again. So you do have to see everything that they're seeing. Mm-hmm. But the issue is that it's one that objectivity itself is more than just seeing all that there is. It's a full process of experiencing, questioning, understanding, reflecting, judging, and being very careful at each step of the way.
Are the people that hold that objectivity, people that hold experiential objectivity as the primary assumption, are they naive realists?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Naive realism is correct. I mean, naive realism will say that that's what objectivity is. But in fact, there's a lot of naive realists who do a lot more than take a good look at everything. It's just that they don't account for it. Naive realism is a theory about what knowing is. But naive realists will, just as any, and empiricists will do a lot more for them, simply experience data of sense, but they don't account for them in their cognition theories. And naive realists will, Etienne Gilson, a Catholic, prominent historian, Catholic thought, and one of the most brilliant, and one that as a historian has Lonergan's full admiration, cognitive theory is naive realist because it doesn't account for the process. There's a fear of this, of understanding, because understanding, accounting for it, how do you get beyond it to judgment? Well, that's the issue for a lot of people. Understanding, an emphasis on understanding can give way to relativism and idealism. And of course it can. Is that fear that if you go in to all of this, you're not going to get out to the real world. But if you take a good look at the real world, you're already out there. You know, well, you're already out there, but there's not much really going on. Or there might be a lot going on, but you can't account for it. Because, anyway, the short answer is yes. George Clumertons once, a teacher that I had in St. Louis, was asked an extraordinarily complicated question. And he just said, no. That was it. Okay, let's break.